Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. It seems like New York state government has always labored under a cloud of corruption, but in recent months, that cloud has become darker. Joining me today to discuss corruption and accountability in state government is Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, better known as NYPIRG. Blair is a longtime observer and critic of Albany's practices. Blair, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with that beginning. I mean, is it true that corruption in New York state government has become worse in recent years?
Well, it's always hard to know exactly what's happening. We know that there have been more convictions than ever before. This is certainly in the past, I'd say, 10 years, has been a spike in the number of lawmakers that are getting caught doing bad things. Whether or not they were doing them in the past, of course, it's hard to tell because there weren't any convictions. But primarily because of the work of former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, making Albany a focus of the investigative powers of his office, there's been an enormous increase in the number of both state legislators and high-ranking members of the executive branch have gotten into trouble under the federal law. And so in that way, it's big, and it's been certainly described by some as one of, if not the most, corrupt state capitals in the country.
You bring up something interesting by mentioning Preet Bharara, because on the one hand, I've heard people looking at these convictions saying, well, the system is working. People are getting caught. On the other, I've heard people saying, well, that's a federal prosecutor doing that. And so it's fortunate that the federal prosecutor decided to, as you just said, look at state actors in this way. So how would we tease that out?
Well, you know, the question really is, I mean, from a policy point of view, is what are the conditions that led to the scandals and corruption? And are the punishments doing anything about them? I would argue no. That just because this one particular federal prosecutor, and in one administration, which is not even in power anymore, decided to focus on political corruption at the state level, does not necessarily mean the system is being cleaned up. So, for example, in some of the most recent cases that dealt with the governor's office, the reforms that have been put in place are largely reforms that deal with the internal processes for how the governor's office monitors how government contracts are awarded, in both the cases dealing with the Buffalo Billion and the ones in actually the three cases, the Syracuse Buffalo Billion, the real estate development in the Hudson Valley dealing around the natural gas plant, those three big ones. It was all about a pay-to-play system in which big campaign contributors were getting awarded government contracts, and that to some extent kickbacks were going back to one particular high-ranking member of the governor's staff. So the governor's reforms in that area have really been about how do you clean that up internally. There hasn't been what we would regard as the meat of reform, which is how do you improve independent oversight of that process? How do you ensure that people in the future will behave differently? There's no indication, at least as of yet, as to whether or not the Trump administration will be as aggressive looking at political corruption at the state level as the Obama administration was. And so if the feds leave the scene, will everything go back to the way it was? And I think that's an open question. And certainly from our perspective, state-based reforms must be advanced and enacted. And it really relies on independent oversight, not on better internal processes, no matter how laudable.
I want to get to the ideas that you have about that independent oversight a little bit later, but I want to stick for now just with discussions of what is the case. And so am I right to understand you then that this internal policy change that you've described in the governor's office is basically the extent of the steps that the state has taken to respond to this recent spate of problems that we're seeing in the news?
The short answer is yes. The longer answer is, of course, there's other corruption scandals that have dealt with the state legislature, for example, which are not touched on by the executive actions and which I would argue have not even been touched on by the legislative branch either. But Yeah, the short answer is we think that they are inadequate to the task at hand.
So maybe this is a dumb or an obvious question, but I have to ask it. Why do you think there hasn't been, then, more of an effort across the different branches of government to respond to the problem?
Yeah, you know, this is sort of the most depressing aspect of this from my perspective. You know, in a normal functioning democracy where you have colossal scandals, public officials run to react. They hold hearings, they have news conferences, proposals get advanced. And certainly in the last couple of years, it's clearly deliberate that none of those things really have happened, and that there's been very little public discussion among the governor and the legislative leaders on how to fix the problem. I think the reason is that there's really two major reasons. One is to actually enact the kinds of reforms certainly that we believe they need to do means that they would have to give up power, and anybody with power is loath to give that up. And the second issue is they don't believe, maybe correctly, but we'll see, that they won't pay a political price for failing to act. And so that, I think, harkens back to the scandals in 2015 when both the then legislative leaders were arrested and charged with corruption, ultimately convicted. No one really paid a price in the elections of 2016 in terms of the state legislature. And so I think they believe that if they just sort of ignore it, don't give any more oxygen to the fire, that it will smolder. People will still be unhappy about it. But they won't pay the political price that really drives lawmakers often to act, even when it's not in their own self-interest.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Blair Horner, Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. I wanted to pick up on exactly that point that you were making about political prices and whether they'll be paid or not. Do you think that this election cycle, it's likely that there will be a difference that we might be able to locate in maybe a couple key races or the overall picture? Because I've been here 25 years. You've probably been in the state longer than me, but I can't remember a time when there ever seemed like there was a big political price, and I can't remember a time when people also said, oh, things are great at state government. So we've been kind of trundling along this way.
Well, I've been working at the state capitol since 1984. And in the late 1980s, there were large scandals both within the city of New York and in Albany, which drove a major debate to overhaul the state ethics laws. And it was a high-profile issue. Then Governor Mario Cuomo vetoed the first proposal that came out of the legislature on ethics reform and demanded more. We actually didn't think that they solved the problem, and sadly, it turned out we were right. But it was much more of there was a Moreland Act commission that was created by then-Governor Cuomo. Moreland Act Commission is a entity under state law that a governor can create to look at malfeasance in government. They issued 20-some-odd reports. They held hearings in which the governor and then-Attorney General Robert Abrams testified under oath in public. They took it very seriously. It was a very different sort of scenario than what you're seeing now. So do I think they'll pay a political price? I think it's too early to tell. I think the Trump administration in Washington and the antics that we see down in Washington suck up a lot of the oxygen out of the room in terms of what the public is paying attention to. And so it may well be that the public, though horrified by what they read about what's going on in Albany, are not paying as close attention to it enough to say when they go to the polling place, I've had enough and let's give some new people a try.
And I also wanted to ask you kind of a question about the taxonomy of corruption, if you will. You know, there are different kinds of political corruption. I mean, there's money stashed away in freezers. There's trading efforts to change or not change public policy for jobs for family members, trading campaign contributions for help with government contracts, and so on. Is there a particular kind or kinds of corruption that New York seems, on the one hand, especially prone to, and on the other hand, that the state is actually pretty good about preventing? How does it shake out that way?
Well, the first part of your question, I mean, it really turns out it's sort of across the board kinds of corruption. I mean, you have lawmakers who are part-time, legislators are part-time in New York like the rest of the country, and they're allowed to have outside jobs with some restrictions, but not many. And some of the most high-profile cases were ones in which the legislator used their public office for private gain. So that's its own sort of cluster of sort of scandals. To some extent, that also played out in the convictions of the high-ranking aides to the governor. They were using their public office for private gain. It was a little more complicated in both cases, but they did that. So there's greedy using every imaginable way to make, you know, to enrich yourself sort of element to the whole problem. New York has a campaign finance problem. I mentioned earlier that then Governor Mario Cuomo created a Moreland Commission. One of the reports they put out was on campaign finance in New York, and they called the system at that time a disgrace. They actually used the word a disgrace. And it's not gotten any better. New York has extremely high campaign contribution limits. You're allowed to make a legal campaign contribution limit of over $109,000 to the political party of your choice. And when you have sky-high limits, the people that can write those checks are wealthy or well-organized interests, and they're the people who want business before the government. And so it's a second element to that. Sometimes that the Venn diagram overlaps between the first two things, but it's about enriching themselves personally or politically. And it's like the public be damned aspect of it. It's almost like when I bring those sort of points up, it's like the people look at me like I'm naive, like what's wrong with you? Why do you even think that this is all supposed to be on the up and up? Again, let me just make one little stipulation here. The vast majority of the public officials I deal with, of course, are honorable people and are here to do the right thing. But there's enough grifters in the bunch that New York has this lousy image. So that's a whole sort of chunk of the problem. Where New York does a reasonably good job, in my opinion, is monitoring the lobbying community. There was a huge scandal in the late 1999 going into 2000 in which the tobacco industry was caught. There was a series of litigations states had with the tobacco companies over how they bamboozled the public about the safety of their products. And as we all know, people get lung cancer and die. And the states sued the tobacco companies saying, well, our Medicaid costs went up because you guys lied to the Medicaid population. And so there was a negotiated deal at the end, and the money was changed hands, et cetera. But one of the things that happened was internal documents of the industry were made public. And independent researchers in New York and reporters identified that the tobacco industry had showered state lawmakers and members of the then Pataki administration with illegal gifts. And so the response by lawmakers and the governor then was to really boost up the state's oversight of the lobbying industry. Now, they didn't look at all about the fact that the people who received the illegal gifts were receiving illegal gifts, and they didn't do anything to them. But the focus was really on improving oversight of the lobbying industry. And I think New York probably has the most far-reaching lobbying disclosure laws of any state in the country. I don't know how well the laws are enforced. It's the same entity that oversees ethics in New York of public officials, and we have issues with them. But generally speaking, there are a reasonably restrictive gift ban. There are requirements for lobbying disclosures for lobbyists who are lobbying even local governments with populations of 5,000 or more, which covers a lot of localities in the state. And so there's a lot of good reporting that goes on. And so that may not sound like the biggest thing, but it is certainly, you asked me, Grant, to come up with something, and I did.
Well, that's an interesting wrinkle. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG, and we're discussing the problem of corruption in New York state government. Well, as you mentioned before, Blair, you've been watching this a very long time, and you've been focusing in particular on the less savory aspects of the state's politics for a long time. I wanted to know, What was the point for you of maximum disappointment and despair? Is there one moment from all of this where you really you just were the most disappointed, I suppose, is the way to say it?
Yikes. Well, you know, it's funny. I've been working with NYPERG for pretty much since 1984. I did a year plus with then Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, and I did 2.5 years as the Vice President for essentially government relations for the American Cancer Society. And so I got to do some other things, but primarily I've been dealing with Albany, and I think it may well be that now is the most unhappy I am with what's going on. And it's because I mean, if somebody had said to me 5 years ago that within a span of 48 months, well, maybe less, 30 months, both legislative leaders, the top aide to the governor and the economic development czar of the governor would all be convicted of corruption and nothing meaningful would happen.
Hmm.
If they had said that to me, I'd be like, no, that's impossible. That's impossible. No matter how bad Albany is, it's a functioning democracy, and they would respond to that problem. And it hasn't happened. And it doesn't look like anything meaningful is going to happen either. And so it's a sort of a depressing sense. I mean, I'm a reasonably optimistic person. I wouldn't be able to do this career that I've had unless I was. And so I still believe that things could change. But the fact that nothing has since essentially February of 2015 till now is a surprise to me, stunning, actually, that elected officials whose job it is to the best of the extent that they can solve problems, cannot even try to solve the problem of corruption, which I would argue is one of the top issues facing the state. It's just mind-boggling to me.
You mentioned earlier the need for an independent oversight process, and I wanted to get into the discussion of possible solutions here. But I wanted to start you off with a bigger think kind of question, and that is, I'll put it this way. Let's say I could give you a magic wand to make one change in the state's ethics infrastructure, but you didn't have to worry about any constitutional limitations. You could just do whatever it is that you would really most like to see happen. What's the one change that you'd want to make in the world that you could create, essentially?
Well, I think it would have to be independent oversight.
Still open, okay.
Yeah, because you can have the best laws in the country, and if they're not independently enforced without political fear or favor, they won't work. And I believe it's the political creatures that sort of cover the landscape of ethics oversight in New York. The fact that they're political in nature and they're inherent, and I don't mean this as any sort of slight on the individuals involved, but they're the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, which is the lead sort of ethics watchdog in the state. The leadership is all appointed directly by the governor and the legislative leaders, who have a stake in what they do, or the state's inspector general, who oversees potential malfeasance in state agencies, is a direct appointee of the governor. The state board of elections is controlled by the two major political parties. I mean, all of the systems, the normal sort of things that you would want to see happen in terms of oversight, the entities that are in control of those are all political in nature. They're not independent in nature. And so even if you came up with a public financing system, for example, a voluntary system of public financing that allowed people to get draw on public resources to run for office, but it wasn't enforced by a real independent entity, it would be a mess. And so to me, the magic wand, if I only get one wish, it's not even Aladdin. I don't get three.
That's right.
It's just one wish. There would be independent oversight.
It's interesting that you say that, because if you ask a political scientist this question, often what they will do with their wand is to make it illegal to have broadcast political advertising. You know, that's what the British do. And, you know, we run into First Amendment problems in terms of the way that speech is interpreted and the relationship of speech to money. So it's interesting that you went for that oversight anyway.
Yeah, I mean, just to give an example, right? So when Shelley Silver, former Speaker of the Assembly, is, you know, negotiating funding for, you know, health department monies. Meanwhile, on the side, he is directing grants to a particular doctor who's giving him a list of particular patients who then he then sends back to his law firm so they can sue. Can sue on those patients' behalf. And that really doesn't have anything to do with broadcast. It's all about somebody just gaming the system and using public resources to become wealthy. And so that's why, I mean, if I had, you only gave me one
that's
wish.
That's true. I didn't
Grant.
Give you,
I mean,
didn't
if you
give
gave me
two,
more
that's
wishes,
right.
I'd have more answers.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Blair Horner from NYPIRG. All right, let's think about this from the citizen's perspective. So citizens in the state regularly give the state poor ratings for ethics and corruption. They are obviously not happy with things. We talked before about how that doesn't seem to rise to the level of making a big difference at the polls, but on election day. But what would you recommend that an individual citizen who's frustrated with this but feeling hopeless, what would you recommend that they actually do? Something that's doable and meaningful to them.
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. And for most people, of course, it's a difficult answer because people are busy. And they have a million things going on in their lives. I mean, the one thing I would urge everyone to do, which is a relatively straightforward thing to do, is to go to the polls and vote your conscience, not vote your partisan affiliation. I think there needs to be a strong signal sent to the governor or whoever the next governor is going to be, the state legislature, whoever, whichever political party controls the state Senate, that the public has had enough, sort of like in the movie Network. You know, they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. And even if it doesn't mean that individuals win or lose, but that it's crystal clear that the public, instead of being disillusioned and not voting, is horrified and voting, I think would send a strong message to the political establishment that they have to do something. And it's a relatively straightforward thing for people to do. In fact, you know, reasonable expectation in a representative democracy is that people show up at the polls. Now, again, that seems sort of like a simple thing, and it doesn't solve the problem per se. But given New York's awful voter participation rates, I think one of the reasons why the establishment figures they can just sort of slough this off is because people don't vote. They're just so disenfranchised by the whole system. They're not going to vote anyway. And therefore, you rely on the special interest groups to turn out the vote. And the special interest groups are the people that want something from you. And sometimes you want something back. And that creates this sort of, as Preparara described Albany, as a cauldron of corruption. What turns up the heat on the cauldron is the fact that voters don't vote.
Well, it also sounds like, and I know your organization is nonpartisan, but it does sound like what I'm taking from this then is that perhaps a close shave for some important figures may be enough to kind of stir things up a bit.
Well, yes. I mean, there are contested primaries. There will be contested general elections. The control of the state Senate is certainly up for grabs. The governor, though, certainly I think most people would view as a favorite going through both the primary and the general election, is facing strong opponents. And so there are opportunities for these issues to get raised, and that's typically what challengers do. I think if people show up, And tell pollsters, you know, I'm fed up with this. I'm going to do something about it. That would shake things up. And, of course, to the extent that they are holding the incumbents accountable for what they have done or not done to fix what ails Albany, I think would also be helpful. But then I'm skirting a little bit closer to being partisan. I don't want to do that. I'm not partisan. Being anti-incumbent, right. I don't want to do that.
I want to give you a chance. We only got a couple minutes left, but I want to give you a chance to talk about something other than corruption. NYPERG is concerned with a whole host of statewide issues. I was curious to know what you think is the most important issue of concern to your group that's not getting sufficiently talked about by at least the candidates that are out there at this point. What's the thing that people should be thinking about that candidates are not talking to them about?
You're not hearing enough about climate change. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, California's burning. The ice sheets are melting. The planet's heating up. This is like the most important issue that the world faces, and we're not hearing enough about it. In fact, the issue gets muddied. In New York, there's sort of a very clear focus. Former Attorney General Eric Schneiderman launched an investigation into ExxonMobil on whether or not they bamboozled investors over what they knew about climate change. And, of course, that's an investigation that doesn't necessarily prove anything right now. But the issue of holding the fossil fuel industry to account for their political activities that have muddied the waters regarding this issue, I think, is an important issue. It's an issue that candidates for attorney general should talk about. Like, what do they think about that investigation? And I think it's an issue that the whole state, country, and world should be putting at the top of the list, because the climate change is already happening. It's going to be terrible for very many people. Many, many people will die early because of the experiences they're going to have to the temperatures, the sea level rise. It's a huge problem, and it doesn't get enough airtime. And I think certainly members of Congress should be talking to their constituents about what they think the nation should be doing, which I believe is not doing enough about the issue of climate change and global warming.
That was Blair Horner of NYPERG. Blair, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.